identified only by core drilling and remote sensing equipment go back before the cataclysmic episode of the Younger Dryas, 12,800 years ago to 11,600 years ago, and deep into the last ice age, when the lost civilization still thrived. The lost civilization that we know only through myths and traditions, and through the works of its survivors as they sought to recreate the former world of the gods. Indonesia must rank amongst the most plausible candidates anywhere on Earth for the heartland in which that civilization could have evolved and grown to maturity. In recognition of this, a number of serious researchers, including Dani Natawijaja and Professor Aricio Santos, have presented evidence that Plato has been misunderstood over the location of Atlantis in the Atlantic Ocean. All the clues, they say, really point east and place the lost civilization between the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. In other words, on the exact spot once occupied by the flooded Ice Age continent of Sundaland, of which the Indonesian islands are the surviving remnant. Mainstream archaeology remains strongly opposed to the notion of any lost civilization by any name, regardless of whether it is said to be located in the west or in the east. In my opinion, however, there's already enough high strangeness around Indonesia to raise question marks over such thinking. A few examples. I've already mentioned Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, quite possibly a completely different human species from our own, that survived for tens of thousands of years after our other evolutionary cousins, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, had vanished from the earth. It's intriguing that the date of extinction of Homo floresiensis appears to have been around 12,000 years ago, exactly in the apocalyptic Younger Dryas window. In its issue of the 8th of October 2014, the prestigious academic journal Nature reported in a tone of astonishment that elaborate, sophisticated cave paintings had been found on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi with a minimum age of 39,900 years, making this art as old or older than anything comparable ever found in Europe, previously considered to be the exclusive home of such early advanced symbolic behavior. And it was Nature again, in its issue of the 12th of February 2015, that reported the discovery on Java of geometric engravings, generally interpreted as indicative of modern cognition and behavior, yet dated to 500,000 years ago, which is 300,000 years older than the supposed first appearance of anatomically modern humans on our planet. If evidence like this that rewrites the human story has remained undiscovered in Indonesia until so recently, how much else is still to be found, and why shouldn't the next turn of the archaeologist's spade reveal a hitherto unrecognized civilization? Given the vast loss of terrain suffered across this entire region as a result of more than 100 meters of sea level rise at the end of the Ice Age, anything is possible. This is why Gunung Padang is so important, and most important of all, perhaps, is that huge chamber, identified by ground-penetrating radar and other remote sensing technologies, lying deep within the pyramid, between 70 and 90 feet beneath its apex. Is it the Hall of Records of the Lost Civilization? Once again, only time will tell. Mountains of Fire and Ash. Gunung Padang wasn't quite the end of our June 2014 research trip. After re-exploring that amazing site, absorbing its ancient, mellow, slightly perplexing atmosphere, and understanding again, even more clearly than before, why it is still to this day known as the Mountain of Light by local people who love and revere it, Santa and I travel back to Bandung, the regional capital. From there, the following morning, we catch a train for the 7-hour journey to Yogyakarta in central Java, where we mean to spend a few days around the fabled Buddhist temple of Borobudur. The train journey is charming, and the endless vistas it affords of rice fields and mountains and green trees, everywhere bursting with life, and the friendly, busy people are a delight. It's nightfall by the time we arrive in Yogyakarta, but the next morning we're up at 4 a.m. to drive to Puntuk Setumbu, a hillside looking down into the valley where Borobudur stands. The air's not cold. It's never seriously cold here. But it's fresh, and there's a wide pool of darkness beneath us. expectant darkness, because that's where Borobudur is, and will soon be lit up by the sun. But the sun rises slowly, light seeping into the sky, gradually illuminating the thickly forested mountainside and the valley below, showing us the distant slopes of the towering twin volcanoes that also overlook Borobudur, Mount Merapi, literally Fire Mountain, which is still active, and Mount Merbabu, Mountain of Ash, which is dormant. By about 5 a.m., the dense trees that carpet the valley floor begin to become visible, though shrouded in low-lying cloud, and soon afterwards a breath of wind stirs the mist, giving us our first glimpse of the massive, jagged, pyramidal form of Borobudur, crowned with a towering stupa that seems to reach for the heavens, a cosmic axis piercing the navel of the earth to connect sky and underworld. As the sun rises higher, the mist swirls and expands, winding and curling amongst the trees, pooling in the deeper parts of the valley. But above it all, Borobudur stands out clear like some mythical island from the dawn of time. We're impatient to visit it after this tantalizing invitation, but we have another plan for today, and drive east out of Yogyakarta, heading first for Surakarta City, usually referred to by its residents as Solo, and then onwards further east to Mount Lawu, another massive dormant volcano. The whole of Java, it seems, is straddled by these slumbering giants, whose outpourings in the past have blessed the island with essential nutrients, making its soils incredibly verdant, fertile, and productive. We wind our way up Lawu's precipitous slopes through green, glittering tea plantations until, at an altitude of 910 meters, 2,990 feet, with the peak of the volcano still towering more than 2,000 meters above us, we reach the little hamlet where Danny Natawijaja has recommended we take a look at Chandisuku, a rather odd and mysterious little temple. It seems out of place in Indonesia, he told us. It looks more like a Mayan step pyramid. This, it turns out, is absolutely correct. Suku, though smaller, is astonishingly similar in general appearance to the step pyramid of Kukulcan Quetzalcoatl at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. Suku was built in the 15th century, just before the conversion of Indonesia from Hinduism and Buddhism to Islam. Why it was built, however, or why its style is so distinctive and unusual for Indonesia, remains a mystery to scholarship. The Kukulcan pyramid, in its present incarnation, though it encloses an older structure, is thought to have been built between the 9th and 12th centuries. Thousands of miles and hundreds of years therefore separate the two structures, and the likelihood of any direct influence of one upon the other is slim. As I explore Suku, however, and it has a mystical air about it, enhanced by a late afternoon mist that wreathes the whole mountainside, I find myself wondering whether the similarities are pure accident, or whether they might not be better explained by the influence in both regions of the same remotely ancient common source. The signal. Certainly, such an influence is present at Borobudur, a pyramid temple consisting of 1.6 million blocks of volcanic andesite, constructed over a period of 50 years from the last quarter of the 8th to the first quarter of the 9th century AD. There is no dedication inscription, indeed almost no inscriptions of any kind. This is, however, undoubtedly a Buddhist monument, a fact of which one could hardly be in any doubt, since its acres of exquisitely beautiful reliefs are devoted, for the most part, to stories from the life of Buddha. Within Buddhist thought, it is to be regarded as a cosmic mountain, a sacred replica of the universe, designed to lead the pilgrim to the realization of full enlightenment, Sambodhi, by which a bodhisattva becomes a Buddha, the ultimate goal of Buddhism. The devotee follows a path to the top of this mountain, keeping his right shoulder to the monument. Subsequently, his path brings him along the many galleries that show panels with scenes in stone relief of which the Buddhist character has become clear, and which have been recognized to represent the ancient Buddhist texts. On this clockwise perambulation of the monument, gradually working your way up from earth to sky, you pass 504 life-sized statues of the Buddha, of which 432 are found on the square stepped terraces, with the remaining 72 on the three circular terraces at the summit surrounding the great central stupa. In addition, calculations of the correct pilgrim route through the four bas-relief galleries have shown that the direction of the path, as well as the number of times that each gallery must be walked, is determined by the bas-reliefs on each side of the gallery walkway. In order to read the entire collection in the correct order, worshippers are compelled to complete a total of 10 circuits around the galleries in the clockwise direction. In so doing, each worshipper passes by a Buddha image an additional 2,160 times before reaching the summit entranceway. The reader will realize immediately, as I did when I undertook my own perambulations of Borobudur, that with these numbers we are back once again in the mysteriously insistent and universal numerical code described in previous chapters. This code, as we've seen, is based on the hard-to-observe phenomenon of the precession of the equinoxes that unfolds at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years, that sees the equinoctial sun housed in turn by each constellation of the zodiac for 2,160 years, and that is deployed to make the Great Pyramid of Giza a model of our planet on a scale of 1 to 43,200. Its presence also at Baalbek and at Göbekli Tepe, and now here at Borobudur, as well as in myths and traditions from all around the world, can only be explained by a remote common influence manifesting in all these places and forms, that almost unbelievable ancestor civilization, identified by Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschend, that first dared to understand the world as created according to number, weight, and measure. It's my intuition, as I've suggested at several points throughout this book, that the lost civilization sought to send a signal to the future, indeed to us, today, in the 21st century, and that the carrier wave of this signal is the precessional code. Two different means were used to ensure the signal's survival through time. First, it was embedded in myths and legends, and in mathematical and architectural precepts that would be passed on and renewed again and again by the different cultures that received them, thus boosting the signal and allowing it to remain intact for thousands of years. Even if those through whose hands and minds the signal passed no longer understood its meaning, the weight of sacred tradition, hoary with age, would ensure that they continued to transmit it and would do their utmost to keep it free from interference. Secondly, the signal was hardwired into certain megalithic sites. Some were hidden in plain view, like the Giza complex, which successive cultures continued to work on and perfect for thousands of years according to the divine canon. Others were buried in the ground, time capsules like Göbekli Tepe and perhaps like that mysterious chamber deep beneath Gunung Padang, and primed for rediscovery when the time was right. There shall be memorials mighty of their handiworks upon the earth, the sacred sermon of Hermes tells us, leaving dim trace behind when cycles are renewed. According to G.R.S. Mead, the pioneer scholar in the field of Gnostic and Hermetic studies, these lines are meant to turn our attention back towards the past, to a time when a mighty race, devoted to growth in wisdom, lived on earth, and left great monuments of their wisdom in the work of their hands, dim traces of which were to be seen in the renewal of the times. Mead finds in this an echo of the ancient conviction that there were alternate periods of destruction by fire and water, and of renewal. In Egypt, the common belief was that the last destruction had been by water and flood. Before this flood, there had been a mighty race of Egyptians, the race of the first Hermes, some dim traces of the mighty works of this bygone, wisdom-loving civilization were still to be seen. And Mead adds, as few modern scholars would dare, I am myself strongly inclined to believe this tradition, and I have sometimes speculated on the possibility of there being buried beneath one or more of the pyramids the remains of some prehistoric buildings that have survived the flood. There is more in the Hermetica that touches on this theme, and quite specifically a reminder of the books of Thoth, of their creation by Thoth Hermes himself, and of their purpose. For what he knew, he graved on stone, yet though he graved them onto stone, he hid them mostly, keeping sure silence, though in speech, that every younger generation of cosmic time might seek for them. Depositing his books, the wisdom god uttered the following words, admitting in the process his own perishability, and thus perhaps that he was no god, but a mortal human being. Ye holy books which have been written by my perishable hands, but have been anointed with the drug of imperishability, remain ye unseen and undiscovered by all men who shall go to and fro on the plains of this land, until the time when heaven, grown old, shall beget organisms worthy of you. Mead provides no explanation of this strange word organisms, sometimes also translated as instruments, but in his own edition of the Hermetica, Sir Walter Scott does. After long ages, he says, it means that there will be born men that are worthy to read the books of Hermes. Has that time come? Are we worthy, at last, to read those books of lost wisdom hidden away before the flood? And if so, what might they say? Part 8. Closure. Chapter 19. The Next Lost Civilization. More than 2,000 flood myths that have come down to us from the remote past are eerily consistent on many points, and on one in particular. The cataclysm was not a random accident, we are told. We brought it upon ourselves by our own behavior, our arrogance and our cruelty towards one another, our noise and strife, the wickedness of our hearts, angered the gods. We ceased to nurture spirit. We ceased to love and tend the earth, and no longer regarded the universe with reverent awe and wonder. Dazzled by our own success, we forgot how to carry our prosperity with moderation. So it was, Plato tells us, with the once generous and good citizens of Atlantis, who in former times possessed a certain greatness of mind, and treated the vagaries of fortune and one another with wisdom and forbearance, but who became swollen with overweening pride in their own achievements and fell into crass materialism, greed, and violence. To the perceptive eye, the depth of their degeneration was clear enough, but to those whose judgment of true happiness is defective, they seemed, in their pursuit of unbridled ambition and power, to be at the height of their fame and fortune. If ever a society could be said to meet all the mythological criteria of the next lost civilization, a society that ticks all the boxes, is it not obvious that it is our own? Our pollution and neglect of the majestic garden of the earth, our rape of its resources, our abuse of the oceans and the rainforests, our fear, hatred, and suspicion of one another, multiplied by 100 bitter regional and sectarian conflicts, our consistent track record of standing by and doing nothing while millions suffer, our ignorant, narrow-minded racism, our exclusivist religions, our forgetfulness that we are all brothers and sisters, our bellicose chauvinism, the dreadful cruelties that we indulge in the name of nation or faith or simple greed, our obsessive, competitive, ego-driven production and consumption of material goods, and the growing conviction of many, fueled by the triumphs of materialist science, that matter is all there is, that there is no such thing as spirit, that we are just accidents of chemistry and biology, all these things, and many more, in mythological terms at least, do not look good for us. Meanwhile, we have made ourselves the possessors of a technology so advanced that it seems almost like magic, even while we use it constantly in our daily lives. Computer science, the internet, aviation, television, telecommunications, space exploration, genetic engineering, nuclear weapons, nanotechnology, transplant surgery, the list goes on and on. Yet very few of us are able to understand how more than a tiny fraction of it works, and as it proliferates, the human spirit withers, and we engage in all manner of reckless crimes, wars and robberies and frauds, and all things hostile to the nature of the soul. Suppose, for a moment, that a cataclysm besets us, a cataclysm so vast that our complex, networked, highly specialized technological civilization collapses, collapses utterly, beyond any hope of redemption. If such a scenario were to unfold, it is likely that the meekest and most marginalized of the peoples who inhabit our world today, the hunter-gatherers of the Amazon jungle and the Kalahari Desert, for example, who are used to making do with very little and whose survival skills are exemplary, would be the very ones most likely to make it through and therefore carry on the story of humanity in post-cataclysmic times. How would their descendants remember us 1,000 or 10,000 years from now? How, for example, might something that we regard as routine, like our ability to receive 24-hour rolling television news and hear sound and view images from all parts of the world and even from outer space, be recollected in myth and tradition? Might it not be said wonderingly of us, as it was of the forefathers recalled in the Popol Vuh, the sacred book of the ancient K'iche Maya? They were endowed with intelligence. They saw, and instantly they could see far. They succeeded in seeing, they succeeded in knowing, all that there is in the world. When they looked, instantly they saw all around them. And they contemplated in turn the arch of heaven and the round face of the earth. The things hidden in the distance, they saw all, without first having to move. At once they saw the world, and so too, from where they were, they saw it. Great was their wisdom. Their sight reached to the forests, the lakes, the seas, the mountains, and the valleys. Yet in common with so many other memories that seem to hark back to an advanced lost civilization of prehistoric antiquity, we learn that in due course the forefathers became arrogant and proud and overstepped their bounds, so that the gods asked, "Must they perchance be the equals of ourselves, their makers? Let us check a little their desires, because it is not well what we see." Punishment swiftly followed. The heart of heaven blew mist into their eyes, which clouded their sight as when a mirror is breathed on. Their eyes were covered, and they could see only what was close, only that was clear to them. In this way, all the wisdom and all the knowledge of the forefathers were destroyed. It is interesting to note the mechanisms used by the gods to keep our ancestors in their place, as described in the Popol Vuh. A flood was brought about by the heart of heaven. A heavy resin fell from the sky. The face of the earth was darkened, and a black rain began to fall, by day and by night. The faces of the sun and the moon were covered. There was much hail, black rain and mist, and indescribable cold. All these phenomena very accurately reflect the complex nature of the cataclysm that afflicted the Earth 12,800 years ago at the beginning of the Younger Dryas Cold Epoch, when, as we saw from the mass of evidence presented in Part 2, many scientists are now certain that the Earth was struck by several large fragments of a disintegrating giant comet. It is my opinion, indeed it's the reason I've written this book, that we need to pay attention to such accounts and the universal details that unite them, whether they come down to us from Mexico, from Peru, from Easter Island, from Mesopotamia, from ancient Egypt, from ancient Canaan, or from Turkey. It's intriguing, for example, against the background of flood and cataclysm it describes, that the Popol Vuh makes mention of fishmen, exactly like the Apkalu sages of Mesopotamia, who had the whole body of a fish, but underneath and attached to the head of the fish there was another head, human, and joined to the tail of the fish, feet like those of a man. Exactly like the Apkalu too, these fishmen reported in the traditions of the ancient Maya possessed magical powers and worked many miracles. It is perhaps not surprising, therefore, that Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the civilization bringer who appears in the Popol Vuh under the name of Gucumatz, should be represented, as we saw in Chapter 1, by an ancient image from La Venta on the Gulf of Mexico, in which he holds the exact same sort of bag or bucket that the Apkalu hold in the Mesopotamian reliefs, and that is also figured on Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. La Venta was one of the centers of the mysterious early civilization of the Olmecs, who left behind sculptures of bearded men, with features that do not look at all like those of Native Americans, but resemble the bearded figures shown in the Mesopotamian Apkallu reliefs and in the statues of Contiki Viracocha at Tiwanaku in Bolivia, again hinting at universal symbolism associated with a group of individuals who sought to disseminate the gifts of civilization all around the world. Moreover, it is widely recognized that the extraordinary astronomical science for which the Maya are famed was part of a wider body of advanced knowledge that had been passed down to them by the Olmecs, and that the Mayan calendar itself is probably best understood as one of these Olmec legacies. As we saw in Chapter 15, a great cycle of the Mayan calendar came to an end on the 21st of December 2012. It is an end date that was calculated to mark the once-in-26,000-year conjunction of the winter solstice sun and the center of the Milky Way galaxy, a conjunction that is itself, because of the diameter of the sun and the limitations of naked-eye astronomy, not so much a precise moment in time as a window 80 years wide spanning the period 1960 to 2040. We saw, too, how Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe uses solar and constellation symbolism to depict the exact same window through which, as any astronomical software program will confirm, the winter solstice sun is still transiting today. My intuition is that these devices, both the Mayan calendar and the Göbekli Tepe pillar, are an attempt, using the precessional code, to send a message to the future. I see the lineaments of that message also in the huge astronomical geoglyph formed by the pyramids and the Great Sphinx of Giza. Using the same code and their relationship to the constellations of Orion and Leo, these monuments draw our attention to the epoch of the Younger Dryas between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, and through the symbolism of the return of the phoenix to the epoch that falls half a precessional cycle later, that is, once again, our own epoch. The targeting here is not so precise as that afforded by the Göbekli Tepe pillar and the Mayan calendar, but then neither is the science by which the impacts that set off the Younger Dryas are dated to 12,800 years ago. The resolution of the carbon-14 evidence upon which scientists base this chronology means that a tolerance of plus or minus 150 years must be allowed. In other words, the Younger Dryas comet, let us for convenience refer to it as the Phoenix, could have struck the Earth as late as 12,650 years ago, in other words, in 10,635 BC, since I'm writing in AD 2015, or as early as 12,950 years ago, in other words, in 10,935 BC. Bearing in mind that half a precessional cycle is 12,960 years, or 12,954 years in the peculiarly exact calculations of the return of the Phoenix reported by Solinus, we are therefore being invited to consider a period that begins in just 10 years from the time of writing, in other words around AD 2025, and that cannot be considered to have passed safely until AD 2325, that is, until the full 12,960 years have elapsed after the latest possible date for the Phoenix impacts. The Mayan calendar and Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe, however, refine the calculation, as we've seen. If I understand the message correctly, we're in the danger zone now, and will be until 2040. I'm reminded of the Ojibwa tradition cited in Chapter 3. The star with the long, wide tail is going to destroy the world someday when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. It came down here once, thousands of years ago, just like the sun. It had radiation and burning heat in its tail. The comet burnt everything to the ground. There wasn't a thing left. Indian people were here before that happened, living on the earth. But things were wrong. A lot of people had abandoned the spiritual path. The Holy Spirit warned them a long time before the comet came. Medicine men told everyone to prepare. Things were wrong with nature on the earth. Then that comet went through here. It had a long, wide tail, and it burnt up everything. It flew so low, the tail scorched the earth. The comet made a different world. After that, survival was hard work. The weather was colder than before. Does it sound like scaremongering to suggest that the comet remembered in this and in so many other myths and traditions from all parts of the globe might be about to stage its great return? Am I reading too much into recondite ancient monuments and calendars and into the fact that everywhere, universally, across all cultures, comets have always been regarded with fear and loathing and as omens of impending doom and destruction? I'm not sure what the right answer to these questions is. From a personal point of view, as a loving father and grandfather, I would greatly prefer it if there was no such danger. Yet at the same time, if there is danger, we would be foolish to bury our heads in the sand and pretend that there's nothing to worry about and no action we need to take. I'm therefore obliged to point out that the most recent science on this subject is in complete agreement with ancient wisdom. There is danger. The House of History is built on sand. We are in the midst of a profound paradigm shift regarding how we view the evolution of human civilization. As noted at the end of Chapter 5, archaeologists have been in the habit of regarding cosmic impacts, supposedly only occurring at multi-million-year intervals, as largely irrelevant to the 200,000-year story of anatomically modern humans. When we believe that the last big impact had been the dinosaur-killing asteroid of 65 million years ago, there was obviously little point in trying to relate cosmic accidents on such an almost unimaginable scale in any way to the much shorter time frame of history. But the nightmare scenario raised by the group of scientists behind the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and supported by the mass of compelling evidence reviewed in Part 2, namely that a huge, earth-shaking, extinction-level event occurred just 12,800 years ago in our historical backyard, changes everything. First and foremost, it means that the historical timeline now taught as fact in all our schools and institutions of higher learning, the slow, painful steps from Paleolithic to Neolithic, the development of agriculture, the rise of the first cities, and so on and so forth, in short, all the conclusions archaeology has come to about the origins of civilization rest on false foundations. For by what word, other than false, can the underpinnings of the existing historical paradigm be described when we now know that they were put in place without taking into account the single biggest cataclysm to hit the Earth since the extinction of the dinosaurs? This cataclysm, moreover, unfolded in a very specific and very recent period, the Younger Dryas between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, and was immediately followed by the first signs of the emergence of civilization at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and soon afterwards at many other points around the globe. To recognize, as archaeologists now do, that these early experiments in civilized living all took place right after the Younger Dryas punctuation mark, yet to take no account of the massive worldwide trauma and destruction unleashed by the cosmic impacts that caused the Younger Dryas, is a real lapse of scholarship. What is worse, however, is the parallel failure to devote even a moment's consideration to the possibility that crucial chapters of the human story, perhaps even a great civilization of prehistoric antiquity, might have been erased from the historical record by those impacts and by the floods, the black bituminous rain, the time of darkness, and the indescribable cold that followed. If our own civilization were to pass through a comparable cascade of giant impacts, would we survive? All the indications are that we would not. And this is why, in my view, the growing recognition of the reality of the Younger Dryas comet lays a duty upon archaeologists to desist, at the very least, from pouring further scorn upon Atlantis and other rumors of a lost Ice Age civilization that have come down to us from the past. Rather than doing everything in their power to dismiss, minimize, and ridicule the myths, the anomalous monuments, and the other tantalizing hints, traces, and clues of a great forgotten episode in human history, The evidence of the comet impacts 12,800 years ago requires that a thorough investigation of these mysteries, drawing on the full resources of science, should be undertaken for the first time. Agenda. Great resistance will have to be overcome before such an investigation can be mounted, and for the same reasons that James Kennett, Alan West, Richard Firestone, and the other leading researchers of the Younger Dryas impacts have faced resistance from their gradualist, uniformitarian colleagues. As Kennett has observed, the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis challenges existing paradigms across a broad range of disciplines, not just archaeology, but also paleontology, paleoceanography, paleoclimatology, and impact dynamics. Inevitably, when one presents new evidence that treads on so many different toes, there is going to be opposition. Academic turf wars, however, are one thing, keeping us all in the dark about a real and present danger that threatens the human future simply because recognizing the existence of that danger requires some scholars to abandon long-cherished positions is quite another. Yet this is precisely what seems to be involved in the ideological attacks, masquerading as genuine criticism, that have been made on the work of Kennett, West, Firestone and others, attacks, as we saw in Part 2, that they have repeatedly and amply refuted, but that can be expected to continue so long as myopic territorialism prevails in science over the rational appraisal of disturbing, and in the case of the Younger Dryas comet, utterly convincing new evidence. And there may be more to this than just an academic turf war. Indeed, something that much more closely resembles a conspiracy to hide unpalatable truths. As I was researching Magicians of the Gods, I exchanged a number of emails with Alan West, since I wanted to check facts, and he's the team member listed as the corresponding author on most of the academic papers about the Younger Dryas impact. Our discussions became quite wide-ranging, and at one point he wrote, "I think your new book will open up the comet hypothesis to a much larger audience, and that is very good for our planet, because this impact topic is not just interesting past history. The Younger Dryas impact was devastating, but much smaller ones could devastate a city, region, or country today, and they are much more frequent than publicly admitted by NASA and the European Space Agency, though there seems to be growing awareness." Picking up on this issue of the apparently deliberate suppression of information about impacts, and about the Younger Dryas impacts in particular, I emailed West as follows. "Having seen the shoddy way catastrophist ideas have been treated again and again down the years, I suppose I should not be surprised by the concerted hostility of your critics, how they spin things, and their constant crowing about the latest requiem for the comet theory, which turns out not to be a requiem at all, but just propaganda, basically. But still, I can't help feeling there is something odd about the way your critics seem almost deliberately to ignore crucial evidence that you have presented in order to generate headlines like study casts doubt on mammoth-killing impact, or to say things like, for the Sirius site, the impact theory is out, when it isn't out at all. Is it just that they desperately want the world to be a safe and predictable place and seek to fulfill their own wish by fudging the facts in their papers? Or is there some other agenda at work?" West's reply was intriguing. "That certainly is one aspect," he said. "One critic complained to me that, well, if you are right, we will have to rewrite the textbooks, as if that were a bad thing. But curiously, some of our most virulent critics are associated with NASA and the government. A NASA employee tells me that this attitude of opposition to impact threats is entrenched in NASA, and is only now slowly beginning to change. When it became obvious to NASA decades ago that asteroids and comets are a serious threat, their employees were instructed by top government officials to downplay the risk. The government was concerned that the populace would panic over space rocks and demand action when NASA couldn't do anything about them and didn't want to admit it. Plus, trying to mitigate any impact hazards would have used up funding they wanted to put elsewhere." The Dark Traveller. As long ago as 1990, before any of the physical geological evidence for the Younger Dryas comet impacts had been discovered, Astrophysicist Victor Klüb and astronomer Bill Napier warned of the view that treats the cosmos as a harmless backdrop to human affairs, a view which academe now often regards as its business to uphold, and to which church and state are only too glad to subscribe. Such a view, in Klüb and Napier's prescient 1990 opinion, was dangerous in that its effect was to place the human species a little higher than the ostrich, awaiting the fate of the dinosaur. As can be seen from the reactions of some members of academe to the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, this view, and what Klüb and Napier call the great illusion of cosmic security that it engenders, are still powerful forces in the world today. Much more than the truth about our own past is at stake, however, for there is a chilling convergence between Klüb and Napier's findings on the one hand, and the findings of Kennett West and Firestone on the other, as to what the Younger Dryas comet really means for humanity. To understand the implications of this convergence properly, it will be necessary to review some of the discoveries made by Klüb, Napier and others in the 1980s and 1990s. Discoveries, remember, that are completely independent of the later work of the Kennett West Firestone team on the Younger Dryas impacts. To cut a long story short, as I've already indicated in Chapter 11, the burden of these discoveries is that it is possible, indeed highly probable, that we are not yet done with the comet that changed the face of the Earth between 12,800 years ago and 11,600 years ago. Klüb and Napier's work, with important contributions also from the late Sir Fred Hoyle and from mathematician and astronomer Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe, has raised the chilling possibility that the Younger Dryas comet was itself only a fragment of a much larger giant comet, one perhaps as much as 100 kilometers in diameter, which entered the inner solar system about 30,000 years ago and was captured by the Sun and flung into an Earth-crossing orbit. It remained relatively intact for the next 10,000 years. Then around 20,000 years ago, it underwent a massive fragmentation event somewhere along its orbit that transformed it from a single deadly and potentially world-killing object into multiple objects grading down from 5 kilometers to 1 kilometer or less in diameter, each and every one of which would still, in its own right, be capable of causing a global cataclysm. The evidence is that it was several fragments on this scale that hit the Earth 12,800 years ago, causing the Younger Dryas. That we crossed the debris stream of the comet again 11,600 years ago, with equally dramatic effects that ended the Younger Dryas. And finally, that we can expect further encounters with the remaining fragments in the future. This unique complex of debris, write Klüb and Napier, is undoubtedly the greatest collision hazard facing the Earth at the present time. The Taurid meteor stream, so called because it produces showers of shooting stars that look to observers on the ground as though they originate in the constellation of Taurus, is the most familiar and best known product of the ongoing fragmentation of the original giant comet. The stream sprawls completely across the Earth's orbit, a distance of more than 300 million kilometers, cutting it in two places, so that the planet must pass through it twice a year, in late June and early July, when the shooting stars are not visible because they are encountered in daylight, and again from late October into November, when a spectacular Halloween firework display is put on. Since the Earth travels more than 2.5 million kilometers along its orbital path every day, and since each passage takes approximately 12 days, it is obvious that the Taurid stream is at least 30 million kilometers wide or thick. Indeed, what the Earth encounters during these two periods is best envisaged as a sort of tube or pipe of fragmented debris, a bit like a huge donut. The geometrical term for such a shape is a torus. Shooting stars are harmless, nothing more than tiny meteors burning up in the atmosphere. So why should we be in the least bit concerned about a meteor stream? In the case of 50 or so distinct and separate meteor streams that have now been discovered by astronomers, the Leonids, the Perseids, the Andromedids, etc., the answer to this question is that in most cases there is probably no danger and nothing to fear. Since most of the particles that they contain are indeed tiny, they represent no threat to the Earth. But it is quite a different matter with the Tories. As Klube, Napier, Hoyle and Wickramasinghe have demonstrated, the torrid stream is filled to overflowing with other much more massive material, sometimes visible, sometimes shrouded in clouds of dust, and all of it flying through space at tremendous velocities and intersecting the Earth's orbit twice a year, regular as clockwork, year in, year out. Amongst the massive, deadly members of the Torrid family are Comet Encke, which is estimated to have a diameter of around 5 kilometers. But Comet Encke is not alone. According to Klube and Napier, there are also between 1 and 200 asteroids of more than a kilometer diameter orbiting within the Torrid meteor stream. It seems clear that we are looking at the debris from the breakup of an extremely large object. The disintegration or sequence of disintegrations must have taken place within the last 20 or 30,000 years, as otherwise the asteroids would have spread around the inner planetary system and be no longer recognizable as a stream. In addition to Comet Encke, there are at least two other comets in the stream: Rudnicki, also thought to be about 5 kilometers in diameter, and a mysterious object named Olgiato, which has a diameter of about 1.5 kilometers. Initially believed to be an asteroid, this extremely dark, Earth-crossing projectile sometimes shows signs visible in the telescope of volatility and outgassing, and most astronomers now regard it as an inert comet that is in the process of waking up. Comet Encke itself is known to have been inert for a long period, until it suddenly flared into life and was first seen by astronomers in 1876. It is now understood to alternate regularly in extended cycles between its inert and volatile states. Klube and Napier's research had convinced them that an as-yet undetected companion to Comet Encke is orbiting at the very heart of the Torrid meteor stream. They believe that this object is of exceptional size, that it is a comet, and that like Encke and Olgiato, it sometimes, for very long periods, shuts itself down. This happens when pitch-like tars that seethe up continuously from its interior during episodes of outgassing become so copious that they coat the entire outer surface of the nucleus in a thick, hardening shell and seal it off completely, perhaps for millennia. On the outside, all falls silent after the incandescent coma and tail have faded away, and the seemingly inert object tears silently through space at a speed of tens of kilometers per second. But at the center of the nucleus, activity continues, gradually building up pressure. Like an overheated boiler with no release valve, the comet eventually explodes from within, breaking up into fragments that can become individual comets, every one of which threatens the Earth. Calculations indicate that this presently invisible object at the heart of the Torrid stream might be as much as 30 kilometers in diameter. Moreover, it is thought likely that other large fragments accompany it. According to Professor Emilio Spedicato at the University of Bergamo, tentative orbital parameters which could lead to its observation are estimated. It is predicted that in the near future, around the year 2030, the Earth will cross again that part of the torus that contains the fragments, an encounter that in the past has dramatically affected mankind. Rebirth. The year 2030 is, of course, exactly in the window of danger indicated by the Mayan calendar and Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe. The dinosaur-killing asteroid 65 million years ago was only 10 kilometers in diameter, yet it set off a global firestorm and changed the world forever. A collision with an object 30 kilometers in diameter would, at the very least, mean the end of civilization as we know it, and perhaps even the end of all human life on this planet. Its consequences, as noted in Chapter 11, would certainly be orders of magnitude greater than the Younger Dryas impacts 12,800 years ago that had 1,000 times the combined explosive power of all the nuclear devices stockpiled in the world today. and that left us as a species with amnesia, obliged to begin again like children, with no memory of what went before. However, it doesn't have to be like that. First and foremost, the universe might spare us. Imagine crossing that torus is a bit like crossing a six-lane freeway, on foot, wearing a blindfold. Luckily for you, however, there's not much heavy traffic on the road. So though you have to cross the freeway twice a year, you usually don't bump into much. What makes some crossings more risky than others, however, is the fact that the big trucks and other heavy traffic do have a tendency to cluster and bunch in places. Effectively, what Klug and Napier have done with their calculations, backtracking the orbits of known objects in the Taurid freeway, is to issue a warning that now and for the coming decades, our crossings carry a greatly enhanced risk of a series of collisions with some very menacing heavy traffic. The evidence that just such a series of collisions occurred between 12,800 years ago and 11,600 years ago, and that fragmentation of the progenitor giant comet that gave rise to all the Taurid objects was the cause, should, at the very least, focus our minds. No longer are we dealing with something that only happens at intervals of multiple millions of years, but rather with what appears to be a cataclysmic process that is still unfolding within the framework of historical time. Even so, we need not give up hope, nor waste a single moment of our precious lives embracing gloom and doom. While I am convinced a civilization flourished during the Ice Age and had mastered advanced sciences that seemed like magic to more primitive cultures, I do not believe that it followed our own particular path of technological development. That path has many negative consequences, but it equips us with abilities that the lost civilization clearly lacked. In particular, the ability to intervene in our immediate cosmic environment and to deflect or destroy asteroids and comets that threaten the very survival of humanity. What it will take is the recognition that we are, after all, one species, one people, one family, and that rather than waste our energies on murderous feuds in the name of God or country or political ideology or selfish greed, the time has come for love and harmony to displace fear and turmoil in every aspect of our lives, so that we can secure the human future. If we are to do this, we will have to stop seeking out our own reflections in the mirror and learn to look up into the cosmos instead. We will have to banish hatred and suspicion and learn to pool our resources, our intelligence, and our talents in a grand effort for the redemption of mankind. We will, in short, have to awaken to the full mystery of the magnificent gift of consciousness and realize we must not squander it an instant longer. For this, too, was the promise of the Mayan calendar, that we who are alive today will find ourselves at the threshold of a new age of human consciousness. If we can bring that age to birth, with all it implies, then preventing the remaining fragments of the younger Dryas comet from devastating the Earth will be child's play. And in the process, we will have discovered, perhaps for the first time in more than 12,000 years, who we really are. It is our choice. It always has been. Nothing stands in our way but ourselves.
We hope you've enjoyed Magicians of the Gods, a Macmillan audiobook production from St. Martin's Press. Text copyright 2015 by Graham Hancock. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.